Session number 9173, reel 13.
Tape 13.
The governor and the two representatives of Greece and Turkey would have a right to refer to a special tribunal any legislation or administrative actions taken by the Cypriot side of the administration, the Cypriot executive, which they deemed to be discriminatory, or to affect the security defence of the island and so on. Apart from that, the Cypriots would have a very wide measure of self-government. In fact, they would run their own affairs apart from the reserved subjects of defence, foreign affairs and internal security. It was suggested in the original plan that they should be given dual nationality. They would be Cypriots in Cyprus, British subjects and British subjects in the United Kingdom, but would then could then have the advantage of Greek nationality in Greece and Turkish nationality in Turkey. This provision for dual nationality was dropped in the modified form of the plan, because I think Athens and Ankara felt that it was going too far to begin with anyway. But that is the sort of thing that was envisaged, and Hugh Foote dubbed it a plan of all the advantages for Cyprus, and that, I think, is pretty fair. Certainly we on our side thought that it did give give the Cypriots the advantages of belonging to Greece and Turkey, which is what they'd said they'd always wanted to do, while continuing to belong to Britain and the British Commonwealth, which gave them certain considerable advantages. The plan got a pretty good reception in neutral British quarters. I think it was the Manchester Guardian at the time, who said that it was a good plan, probably as good as could be devised in present circumstances. And it was based on what seemed to be the aspirations of the two peoples in Cyprus at that time. Here was a very high degree of recognition of their Greekness and Turkishness. And then it envisaged that in the course of time there might even be shared sovereignty, though no attempt was made to spell that out. Well, condominium is a very difficult concept and is usually a subject for humorous anecdotes rather than serious policy. But there are some cases where, in spite of it being cumbersome and difficult to run and so on, a system of shared sovereignty is better than allowing disputes to continue. We can all think of cases which still exist in the world of that kind. So it was a bold and I think reasonably justified attempt to break through to, I suppose we would say nowadays, to break the mould of the Cyprus dispute. And I don't think the British need to be on the defensive about it. After all, at that time, nobody in Cyprus, anyway, had shown the slightest interest in independence. Now, looking back on it with hindsight, some people criticise the Macmillan Plan because it was proposing an external domination of Cyprus by the three powers, rather than giving independence to the people. But that independence had not been what they were seeking. They had been seeking to identify themselves with Greece and Turkey. So, in the circumstances which existed up to that time, it did seem like a reasonable attempt to meet and satisfy the national aspirations of the Greek and Turkish Cypriots without endangering the future security of the island and relations between Greece and Turkey and damage to a NATO alliance and so on by pursuing the old aims of Ennis and partition. It didn't get a good reception. The plan didn't get a very good reception in other quarters. I think Archbishop Macarius immediately denounced it as an imperialistic monstrosity. I believe those were his words. Greece denounced it, and oddly enough, to begin with, the Turkish Cypriots that did surprise us. I think they came out against it, but very shortly, Ankara had either had second thoughts itself or taken control. Anyway, Ankara came out in favour of the proposal. Now, tactically, this was very different from any scheme that the British had tried before, because they all previous schemes, including the Foot Plan, had depended on getting a degree, anyway, of cooperation from both Greek and Turkish Cypriots, and that had not been forthcoming because of the conflict over the final status of the island. Now, this time, we could have made it work after a fashion if either Greece or Turkey agreed to cooperate. We could then set up machinery, bring in the representative or representatives of Greece and Turkey, and operate the plan after a fashion, even if there weren't a cooperation from both the Cypriot communities. And Macmillan made a fair amount of tactical use of this. He made it perfectly clear that the British were going to go ahead with this scheme, even if it it didn't receive approval from some of the others concerned. And in fact, it was possible to do so, as I've said, so long as either Greece or Turkey came in. Because if Turkey came in, as actually happened, they appointed their representative, then that faced the Greek Cypriots and Greece with a very, very difficult problem indeed. It meant that the Turkish presence was established on the island and in the machinery of government. If they, if then the Greeks and the Greek Cypriots acquiesced in this or did nothing about it, it simply meant that the Turkish position would be increasingly entrenched in the island. Similarly, of course, if the Greeks had felt able to take part and Turkey had not, similarly the pressure then would have been on Turkey. So tactically it had great importance, and as matters turned out, it was in fact the tactical effect of the Macmillan plan, which became most important. That is not to say that it was in itself a bad plan or unprincipled. As I've said, it was based on a region an acceptance and understanding of the national aspirations of the Cypriots. And although it doesn't nowadays get a very good press, who can say whether in the end this kind of system of self-government under the aegis of the three powers wouldn't have been a happier solution for the Cyprus problem, for the Cypriots themselves, than an independence which they didn't want at that stage anyway, and which, as it turned out, didn't work well and led to renewed conflict and dissension. So I think it was a plan, an initiative, which is defensible both in principle and as a tactical measure. The tactics certainly worked out because the Macmillan plan confronted the ethnarchy really with a choice of compromise and only compromise instead of enesis and only enesis. If they didn't take it up or didn't moderate their position, then things were going to go get increasingly worse for them. And Makarios at once perceived this and realized that he'd got to shift his position and moderate his ground. And so within quite a short time, he had announced that he was prepared to drop, at any rate, the immediate exercise of self-determination in favour of independence. He made this announcement to Mrs. Castle, Barbara Castle, when she was visiting Athens, and I've heard her since claim a great deal of the credit for persuading the Archbishop at last to abandon the intransigence of enesis and to go for independence. I'm sure she did her best to persuade him in that direction, to persuade him of the advantages of independence, but I'm sure that in reality he'd already made up his mind that he got to do something like that in order to counter the Macmillan initiative. One of the essential points, of course, in the plan was that I believe Macmillan was very careful not even to use the word partition when presenting the plan, nor enesis. But in effect, it did rule out both enesis and partition, because if Greece had come in on it, then clearly any future decision about the island would have required a Greek consent, and so that meant that if the Turks wanted partition, they would have had to obtain a Greek consent, and vice versa. If the Turks came in, then enesis would only be possible with their consent. So virtually, in effect, this did rule out enesis, both enesis and partition, and set open the way for a compromise. This was of great significance later on, because I believe, anyway, that it was the Macmillan Plan which opened the way for the Zurich and London settlements, for Greece and Turkey to get together and reach a compromise. And in fact, the Zurich settlement between Greece and Turkey did borrow a great deal of the ideas and thinking in the Macmillan Plan, although it's perfectly true that it substituted Cypriot independence for a tripartite association for putting Cyprus under the aegis of the three powers. And so by the end of the year, things really had begun to move. They still seemed to be deadlocked at the United Nations in New York during the debate. The Greeks once again had raised the question there. But after it was over, Zorlu made a conciliatory gesture to Averrof, and then they got together and began discussing the ideas which eventually took shape in at Zurich. And then I think it was in January of the following year, 59, they met at Zurich and the prime ministers as well, and worked out the Zurich settlement, which, as I said, was a scheme for an independent Cyprus with Ennesis and partition specifically ruled out, and they'd borrowed from the Macmillan Plan the idea of separate communal chambers dealing with specifically Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot affairs. A tribunal of guarantees to which discriminatory measures could be referred, with a neutral judge, and then with both Greek and Turkish Cypriots serving on it. Substantial safeguards for the Turks in the form of, first of all, the tribunal guarantees. They were to have their separate municipalities, which they attached great importance to, in the main towns, and a fixed quota in the public services, larger quota than they were entitled to on a purely proportionate basis in terms of population. I think it was to be 70 against 30 in the public services and 60 against 40 in the armed armed forces. They were to hold one of the three key ministries of ministry, finance, or defence. And then the settlement was to be guaranteed by Greece, Turkey, and Britain. And that was to give rise to difficulty later. The form of guarantee was that the three powers guaranteed the independence, integrity, territorial integrity of the island, and had the right, though not the obligation, to intervene either jointly or, if that failed, separately. And this is the interesting point, separately, to restore the state of affairs in the 1960 Constitution, something of that kind. What precisely that meant, I've never been quite sure. It seems to give a general power of guarantee, and then to narrow it down afterwards in terms of a right of intervention to simply restoring the basic state of affairs in 1960. But anyway, there it was. That was the international guarantee. Then when it came when this was presented to the British, they had for some considerable time past come round to the view that if ever Greece and Turkey agreed on some scheme for the future of the Cyprus, of Cyprus, however unlikely that might seem. But if they ever did, then it really would be virtually impossible for Britain to stand out against it. We would have to go along with a Greco-Turkish solution of the problem. But what we could and should do would be to insist the maintenance of our defence interests in the island. And so we said, this is agreeable to us, provided we have sovereign bases enabling us to discharge our defence obligations in the Eastern Mediterranean. I can remember when the details of the Zurich settlement came through on the by telex in Nicosia. I was in Government House at the time, and as it came off the machine, the Hugh Foote read it and then passed it on to me, and we both thought it was a miracle. It was absolutely miraculous that Greece and Turkey at last had managed to get together and produce an agreed solution. Certainly there were odd features in it. The safeguards for the Turks seemed to go rather far, but that was the price which the Greeks were expected to pay for having, after all, upset the apple cart in Cyprus and started the whole violence. In any case, although the Greeks later maintained that the whole thing was dreadfully biased towards the Turkish Cypriots and gave them excessive power, in fact, the sinews of power really did remain in Greek Cypriot hands. They would continue to command the economic heights, the commercial heights. They would continue to have a majority voice, even though the Turkish safeguards could, to some extent, frustrate it. But now, looking back on it, I think most Greek Cypriots agree that they were very foolish not to make this scheme work in spite of the shortcomings which it certainly had from their point of view. So then the Zurich agreements were embodied in the final settlement in London, together with the British requirements. It has been said on the Greek side, with some justice, that this was an enforced compromise. Makarios hesitated and hedged right to the last moment in London, and in the end was faced with a take-it-or-leave-it decision. Even the Greeks made it clear that he would be, Averrof made it clear that he would be on his own if he decided not to accept. And after much agonizing, so Kranidiotis tells the story of how the evening, the morning before the final meeting, Makarios had asked for another 24 hours. The morning before the final meeting, Kranidiotis went to see Makarios in his hotel in London, and he'd been agonizing all night long trying to decide what to do. And Makarios used the Greek words tetelesti, which is what Christ said on the cross, it's finished. In other words, I've got to go along with it. And so he went along with it and made a statement at that final session saying that he welcomed independence and this was a new era and he would do his best to make it work. We'll come on later to get to whether it was workable or unworkable, but certainly at the time it was widely greeted throughout the world as a miraculous delivery from the way out from all the strife and turmoil and bloodshed which had gone on in Cyprus for the previous 3 or 4 years. One Greek Cypriot historian of leftist persuasion has said recently that the Zurich and London settlements were a rogue's deal, that it was just something cooked up between selfish Greek and Turkish governments and the imperialist Macmillan. But that really doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
I now suppose you had to start preparing the constitution. Were you involved with this in any way?
Yes. Well, the settlement provided that a detailed constitution and other should be worked out and other matters resolved within a period not exceeding 12 months from the date of signing of the agreement. In fact, it did drag on a bit longer. But then working groups were established to deal with particular aspects, and there was one on which, of course, both communities were represented, and the others concerned, to work out in detail the constitution, how a public services commission would operate, the extent of the British bases, and the facilities to be given to Britain for its defence installations outside the bases and things of that kind. And then in Cyprus itself, the governor reformed the governing body, the Executive Council, by inviting Makarios and Dr. Kuchuk, the leaders of the two communities, to sit in on the council and to nominate shadow ministers to sit with the British officials and, to some extent, I suppose, to understudy them. I worked very closely during the ensuing period with Tassos Papadopoulos, who was designated at that time, or appeared to be designated as the Minister of the Interior, the future Minister of the Interior. In fact, he didn't take that job up in the end. But we worked closely and well together, because I suppose my job as Administrative Secretary did cover a good deal of the subject matter of a Ministry of the Interior. Mm-hmm. And the others, and in the other fields of finance and law and so on, similar arrangements were made. Naturally, the power during this transitional period still remained with the governor and his office.